You're where it's at, folks, here on allthingstrek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Warren.
Oh, man. So,
yeah.
For probably the first time in a long time, I played myself a game of Warhammer 40,000.
And how did that go?
Well, I lost.
Okay.
I was playing against a coworker from Private Press, our work.
Strong choice.
At Games Workshop. I know, it's kind of crazy how that works out, huh?
Uh-huh.
But,
There's actually a lot of cross-pollination, you'd be surprised.
Well, it's because there's just so little miniatures wargaming that's popular out there.
That's true.
I mean, like, it's kind of like our stuff, and then there's Games Workshop, and there's a couple other kind of more little more obscure ones.
Yeah.
That I'd like to do, but they're not, like, you
know, it's hard to find someone popular. To play with.
Like, there's not a lot of players in the area, you know, as opposed to a lot of people, especially with, like, the internet and internet wargaming out there. A lot of people have just shifted to that. Like, I'll guarantee you that there's more Axis and Allies games going on in the internet than there are in actual real life.
Oh, well, that's a fact. But that's partly because Axis and Allies takes, like, an hour to set up.
Yeah. But I had a lot of fun despite the fact losing. That I lost. It was really nice just to bust out my Black Templars and start rolling dice again.
Black Templars are a Space Marine faction?
They are.
All right, what was your opponent playing as?
Chaos.
Oh my goodness.
Chaos Space Marines.
More classic matchup there hasn't been.
Well, you know, I mean, he's had a lot more recent experience. I had an army which was a bunch of foot sloggers, which is a lot of infantry out on the table, and apparently that's a big no-no in this edition. So.
Yeah. A lot of things have changed since the last time I played Warhammer. All right, speaking of things that are dark and grim, in honor of Halloween, today we are going to be talking about horror in Star Trek.
Spooky! Ooh.
I know, right? And I'm actually trying to go for a bit of a horror bent on my Star Trek RPG right now, which I can't say too much about because Bob is in it. and I don't want to give away a lot of spoilers. And I'm especially sad because I may end up losing my Trill Science Officer.
Oh man, the engineer and my science officer play with a Ouija board.
Oh, goodness.
Whee!
Let's not get into Ouija boards.
See how many ghosts are on the USS Compass.
Lots of ghosts.
Oh, man.
So many ghosts. Especially since, well, you guys just got your first Vitality. He's totally going to haunt you guys. They're like, you did
it. Exactly. There you go. I'm providing a service to the crew by allowing them to say their final farewells to them.
Okay. All right.
The poor shuttle crewman.
He was just a crewman. He was a gold shirt. Crewman Yates. But anyway. All right. So, on the topic of horror, Star Trek, in general, is kind of hit and miss when it comes to horror. They've had a couple of good episodes, but I think most people will remember the silly ones more than the good ones. So hopefully I can correct some of that, because there are some really good ones in here. And sci-fi and horror have gone hand in hand for a long time, especially like since like the 30s, really, because that was when...
Frankenstein.
Before that, I guess, Frankenstein. And then like you have Lovecraft, a lot of Lovecraft's stuff is partially sci-fi. Like, a lot of Lovecraft's evil monsters were actually just aliens.
Yep.
You know, like the Mego and the Elder things. And there's a big argument for the Elder gods are even aliens. Like, Cthulhu could just be an alien. There's a lot of that comes down to how you define the difference between a god and a very powerful alien.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, there's a lot of sci-fi in there. And so, I guess the first thing, before we get into specific examples, what makes good horror? And that's a hard question to answer, but there are a couple of sort of recurring themes that you see coming up. And
what makes good horror is you get five characters, specifically teens, that you don't care about, and you hack them away one by one.
I think that makes...
And typically you start with the two that are about to get it on the sleeping bag.
Especially if one of them is a minority.
That's my understanding of good horror.
I think that's that's a good understanding of slash porn. that's
like
almost,
I said, horror.
I guess. It's interesting how, like, the modern horror movie, the slasher film, doesn't really follow any of the classic horror tropes because, like, it's hard for you to really get invested in most of those stories just because of how unlikable the characters tend to be.
Yeah.
And I think they do that on purpose because they want, it's more of a gore fest. And if there is anything scaring you, it's usually startling you because something jumped out.
Yeah.
And very often there's not really all that much to be frightened of. Although I will make an exception. The recent, I think it was the Halloween. Halloween is the one with Michael, right?
Mike Myers,
yeah. The recent...
Except, like, the hockey
like,
mask thing in
semi,
the city.
No, that's Jason Voorhees. Mike Myers is someone else. Jason Voorhees doesn't have a mask. Mike Myers doesn't have a mask. He's just, like...
Yeah, he does. Maybe he doesn't have a machete. I know Jason Voorhees has a machete. But Mike Myers does have a mask. It's not a hockey mask, excuse me. It's one of those masks that looks like a face that goes on top of your face.
Yeah, yeah.
It's obviously like a plastic form.
Right.
But
the remake of Halloween that came out a few years ago was actually really scary, because they actually followed some of the classic serial killer tropes. Like, before he turns into a slasher, Mike Myers is, like, when he's a little kid, he's a bedwetter, and he kills animals, and, you know, some of the classic serial killer functions. And then he has this bizarre fascination with his sister, and, like, so that sort of thing was actually pretty scary. But for the most part, slasher films are just there to gross you out.
Uh-huh.
However, one of the things that makes, like, a true horror story is, like, the unknown. And this is sort of getting back to the way it works in sci-fi. And the unknown is pretty clear. It's like, you know, humans fear what they don't understand.
Right, of
and
course.
That's sort of a, you know, an instinctual habit we've developed because if we...
I actually got a good example of that, too.
Oh, yeah? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a scuba diver, as maybe people don't know out there. I'm a diver. I've been doing it since 7th grade, so... like 12 years old, I've been doing it for 9 years.
He spies on us for the ocean.
I do that. It's true. I must go. My people need me. that's an inside joke probably no one's going to get. But anyway, my dad and I were diving out in the Catalina Islands, which is just west of LA, out mm-hmm. in the ocean place, all that good stuff. And man, it's really actually really awesome. It's clear water.
Yeah.
But anyway, there was this, it looked like a rock.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't actually a rock, though. It was some type of crustacean.
Oh, my.
I had no idea what it was. And I was just, like, swimming up to it and whatnot, and my dad and I were just looking at this thing, and we're just kind of like, well, what is it? And I poke it real quick, and all of a sudden it jumps up, and it's like, gah! I look at those claws up. I'm like, oh, my God! Maybe that's a startle factor, but I didn't know what it was at the time. I had some trepidation when I approached it.
No, definitely. And, like, I mean, heck, just going into the water is a serious horror for a lot of people because, you know, we don't know what's down there. I mean, like, you know, there's the people love to say that we know more about the surface of the moon than we do the depths of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a completely alien environment, which is why a lot of really good horror movies have been set underwater. Because it's just, you know, one of the least in our element places we can possibly
be. Or things that come out of the water.
Yeah, or things that come out of the water. I mean, you know, Jaws, just to cite a random example. And despite the fact that Jaws is now looks a little goofy because of special effects improvements, we do, and like, and because it's become so commonplace that it's a little trite, but when it first came out, it was, you know, and even after that, it is very effective in terms of horror and building suspense and actually, like, getting you invested in what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of segues into the other scary thing are threats. And obviously threats are scary because they directly threaten our survival.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we have a fear reaction so that we will get away when there are threats. Because mm-hmm. if we didn't have that, and there was a threat, and we didn't leave, we would die. And we would have a hard time passing on our genes when that happened.
That or we're super aggressive and beat it up.
Yeah, that too. And there's a balancing factor between, you know, that's what the fight or flight reflex is for.
Uh-huh.
And so what you do, you know, with the classic horror, the simplest way to do horror is to put the unknown together with something threatening. It's a lot of successful horror writers have said that the scariest part of any horror is watching something approach, and when you don't really know what it is and it's threatening, like it wants to hurt you in some way, but you don't know how or why, and it's like the unknown combined with the vague danger is what really sets off all of our fear reactions.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can see that because most of the time in horror movies, once the monster is revealed, it gets way less scary, which is why good horror movies either never reveal the monster or reveal it at the very end. And that's sort of the classic. And I mean, just for example, the recent Super 8 movie.
I never saw.
Which I actually thought was pretty good. It was a sort of an homage to Stephen King movies.
Yeah.
And it was pretty good. And and at the end, like, I don't want to put any spoilers, but they reveal the monster very close to the end. And by then the movie has a bit, sort of changes themes. And I guess I'm going to reverse that. I mean, I'm going to spoil this because there's no way I can explain it without spoiling it. So skip
ahead. I'm not concerned.
So skip ahead.
It's been out for a little while.
Yeah, skip ahead if you don't want to get Super 8 spoiled for you. But at the end, they sort of, when they finally do reveal the monster, it's only a couple minutes until the monster stops being the bad guy. Because at that point, it's revealed that the monster is actually just trying to get home.
Mm-hmm.
And he isn't, like, he's trying to leave Earth. And he's done some bad things, but that's mainly because he was so badly scarred by the government organization that had captured him for a while.
Big, mean general man.
He just thought that all humans were evil because they were torturing the shit out of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, at that point...
Is it an alien or is it a monster?
It's an alien.
Okay.
But it basically looks like the Cloverfield monster because it's just smaller. Because
well, Super 8 was a J.J. film, right?
Yeah, J.J. Yeah. Abrams loves to reuse that one monster. He used it in the Star Trek film, too.
Huh, now I'm going to have to go research Super 8 plus Cloverfield now.
Yeah, just do it. And then there's one more big trope of horror, which is twisting the familiar. And that is taking something that we normally find to be safe or comforting or just something that we are comfortable with, and then turning it into something threatening. We have The Ring, just to name a classic example of that, where we have the little girl. And normally little girls are cute and fun, and we like them. And then suddenly, oh god, this little girl is crawling out of a well, and she's gonna murder me.
Oh my
and
goodness.
It's, like, so much scarier than it would have been if she was, like, a hulking monster or something.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, it's like, man, that's twisting the familiar. And then we have movies where, like, the mother becomes, like, a murderer, and it's like, mothers are our caretaker figures who protect us from bad things. And then suddenly, bam, now this mother's trying to kill you.
Oh, my goodness.
What are you going to do about it? And as a rule, sci-fi is really good at unknown threats. Not so good at twisting the familiar. But, of course, there are exceptions, and one of which we will get to. All right, and usually, at the end, when all is said and done, a good horror piece either shows us something about ourselves, like reveals some kind of truth, or it gives you cathartic release, or both.
Uh-huh.
And that's why people go to horror movies, is because, you know, they feel better after it. It's like, you know, an emotional cleansing, as it were. And some horror movies fail at that, and you leave just feeling kind of icky. Like a lot of the Jason movies come to mind for me, where I feel like there was no real, like, end to it, and there was no conclusion. It was just like, oh, I saw Jason murder a bunch of people, whatever. Whereas at the end of the recent Halloween movie, I did feel like I had been cathartically purged, as it were. I felt better because I had gotten a chance to sort of work through those dangerous, like, this, you know, those negative emotions, and then, you know, it's sort of a form of therapy.
What about the Paranormal Activity movies?
I haven't seen any of those.
Uh-huh.
I'm not actually big on horror movies in general.
Oh, okay.
I had a hard time sitting through Mike Myers, or the Halloween movie, but I felt good at the end. There was one part where I almost walked out when I thought he was going to kill the baby. He didn't kill the baby, and I should have seen that coming because you can't kill babies on television.
Well, not depict the actual act anyway. All right, well, I have yet to see it actually done in a non-comedic way anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen
a
serious story that revolved around a baby actually dying.
What do you mean serious?
Well, I mean, like, comedic stories do, but like for example, there's this...
Like Dawn of the Dead, they totally kill a zombie baby.
Well, that's true, but that's a zombie. Zombies are a whole other thing, which we might get into a little bit once we get to the Borg. But... The first actual Star Trek, because, you know, we're like 13 minutes in and now we're finally getting to the Star Trek part.
Woo!
But the first actual Star Trek horror movie, horror episode, when I think Star Trek and I think horror, the first thing that comes to mind is the TNG episode Genesis. And not to say that Genesis is a great episode, because it's not.
Nope, definitely not.
But it is an example of horror, and they do a few things right. And to recap for people who aren't familiar with the episode I'm talking about, Genesis is where Picard and Data go off in a shuttle for some kind of contrived reason.
To find a torpedo is what it is, because Worf had engineered this, oh, I've got this great new guidance system, we can use their torpedoes. Like, all right, let's test this bitch out. They fire the torpedo, and it, like, veers off course very suddenly away from the asteroid they're shooting at, and they have to go retrieve the torpedo.
And for some reason, they couldn't just send the Enterprise to do that.
They couldn't send the Enterprise, but why would you retrieve the torpedo in the first place?
Well, I could see them retrieving the torpedo if this was, like, near a major shipping lane or something.
Why are they testing weapons near the shipping lane?
I don't know. But, I mean, even if it's not near a shipping lane, it's bad manners to leave unexploded ordnance lying around, even in space. This is not, you know, it's not something you should do. I mean, granted, it's not nearly as big a deal as it is to leave one around, like, you know, in a cornfield or a rice paddy or something. But it is definitely not good. You don't want to go around leaving unexploded weapons. Especially something with, like...
Yeah, but a torpedo has always been characterized as a fire-and-forget weapon. It's going to explode one way or another.
Well, apparently not these ones.
Not these ones. Dumb torpedos.
Yeah, I mean, well...
The seventh season of TNG, they had different torpedoes.
Yeah, this was a new torpedo, remember? So for some reason, they send Picard and Data, which, because when I think of ordnance retrieval, the first person that comes to my mind to do it is a 60-year-old captain, who has, as far as I know, had very little weapons experience.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, he's a tactician, but I don't think he ever actually worked on weapons. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, really, Worf and Data would have been a better better combination. I don't think I would have even, I don't know if I even would have sent Data. I don't know if Data has the expertise. Data's pretty much good at everything, but Worf definitely should have gone. Granted, it was Worf's fuck-up that, it was Worf's screw-up that originally caused this in the first place, so maybe they were just like, no, Worf, you get to go back in the Worf box.
Back in the Worf box.
You enjoy what you have until Deep Space Nine rolls around. but anyway, while the ship is gone, while Picard and Data are gone, some kind of virus happens, and the crew start to de-evolve.
What happens is Barclay comes in with a cold, yeah, or some sort of flu that's got a really complicated name.
Yeah, yeah.
And what Crusher does is says, all right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to give you chicken soup and Sprite. What I'm going to do is I'm going to modify this genetic thing in your genes so you can fight this virus.
I'm going to give you gene therapy to fight a cold.
I'm sure it's a little more specific than that, but she does something to, like, T-intron cells or something like that is what they're called. And she's modifying genetics a little bit is what she's doing. Now, what happens is that this thing is actually becoming airborne and spreads the entire ship, and it starts flipping genetic switches for everybody and de-evolving them.
De-evolving them. Because remember, in Star Trek, the human DNA rewrites itself at the drop of a hat. And the idea that, and like, part of it is based on real science, is the idea that we have all these genes hanging out that don't do anything from, like, you know, back when we used to be different creatures. And that's true. We do still have those.
Yep.
But of course, as has been pointed out, if you turned them on, you would just die. you wouldn't start to de-evolve. But whatever. We'll accept this premise. The crew is de-evolving, and for some reason, they're all de-evolving into different animals. I assumed it would all be the same animal, but no. I assumed all the humans would de-evolve into the same thing, but not apparently not. Because, like, Barclay is devolving into a Spider-Man, and, like, Riker starts de-evolving into an ape of some kind.
Some kind of Neanderthal.
Neanderthal. Picard, once Picard finally gets back on the ship, he's going to start devolving into, and this is my favorite line of the episode, a lemur or pygmy marmoset, as Data says.
Starts swinging through the ship looking for breakfast.
And the look that Picard gives him is just like, really? Not something cool? Not like a silverback gorilla or like a tiger or something? Really? A pygmy marmoset? Not even a regular marmoset. But anyway, so this episode, like, it's kind of weird because it divides the horror into two parts. Because you have the first part where it actually shows the crew de-evolving and they're trying to deal with that. So on the one hand, it's got, like, the crew trying to deal with this looming threat, and that's kind of horror. But then, like, it cuts away from that to later, where Picard and Data are in the ship and it's a monster movie suddenly, because Worf is devolved into some kind of proto-monster Klingon, where he can, like, spit acid and stuff. And so it's kind of got that weird divide between like, the psychological medical horror and then the, oh my god, there's a monster that's going to kill us. the impact of which is lessened somewhat because if Worf had picked Data to go hunting instead of Picard, Data just would have, you know, knocked him right out and wouldn't have had a problem.
Yep.
So that impact was a little bit lessened. It also, they kind of mess around, like, they have, like, the whole dark corridors, because remember, when you're doing a monster movie, you have to make everything dark. But there's not really a good explanation for why everything is dark, because the ship's only been offline for, what, like, a day by the time they get back to it?
No, they've been gone for, like, a week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Took them that long to go get the torpedo?
That being said, we've seen, well, like, I mean, I know it was a week later, though.
Okay.
Due to just the exposition of the episode when they're coming back from the torpedo retrieval mission. Mm-hmm. Which still seems so silly to me. But so they come back. But that being said, we know that starships can't operate at normal, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, normal operations without anybody actually around for more than a week.
Yeah, so it was weird that all the lights.
Like, saw that in Voyager, for instance, as much as I hate to cite Voyager for things that, you know, are, you know, precedent setting.
Yep. We don't like to do that, but in this case, I mean, I don't think we need even, I'm positive there's another episode where we get to see that, but it's, you know, after, like, a week, the ship's lights have all turned off.
Operating in, like, emergency power or auxiliary power, right, and stuff. And,
of course, we have the same problem that we do with any we have to get somewhere on the ship in a hurry episode, where they have a perfectly operational shuttle, even if for some reason all the ship systems aren't working. They have this thing where they're, like, running around the ship, and, like, time is this huge factor, because if they don't, A, Monster Worf will kill them, or B, Picard will de-evolve too fast.
Let's not use the shuttle transporter.
Yeah, don't use the transporter and the shuttle to get where you need to go. No, sir. See, this is a problem with the transporter. We talked about way back in our first episode, we talked about how sometimes they put a piece of technology in and they forget its ramifications.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, this episode...
Starfleet doesn't want to do things the easy way. We're trying to do things the hard way.
No, sir. And so, like, this episode, I did enjoy the monster hunting segments, just because, you know, I thought they were fairly well put together in terms of their technical execution. I was, you know, I was afraid of Proto-Worf, even though this episode started off with Worf demonstrating his incompetence, he was actually more competent as a monster. And like,
can you really say that? Because he failed to kill...
Yeah.
I mean, but, I don't know how many other crewmen he ate before Picard and Data got there, but I mean...
Yeah, they don't... They tactfully avoid that.
Because, you know, a week goes by, the animals get hungry.
Yeah, they tactfully avoid the question of, did Worf kill anyone else while they were waiting?
I'm sure that somebody somewhere got eaten by someone else. Just had to have happened.
Yeah, that's... And then, of course, the creepiest moment for me, visually speaking, was when they found, like, Troy as, like, a frog in the bathtub. Like, a Troy frog. Yeah,
in her neck and
yeah,
stuff.
That was kind of creepy looking. Mainly, I think, because she still had, like, her human face, but she, like, had this really blank look, which was partially makeup and partially, you know, Marisa Ortiz did a pretty good job there. But, like, that kind of freaked me out. And, you know, we have a little bit of the twisting of the familiar there. Whereas, like, Barclay as a giant spider wasn't really that creepy. Because he was like...
I loved Barclay's transformation. Where he just was... He acted like he was hopped up on caffeine.
Yeah.
Right? He was just talking really fast and had these really just kind of calculated movements as he's moving around the briefing room.
I forget the name of Barclay's actor, but he did a pretty good job there.
Dwight Schultz.
Dwight Schultz is rad.
He is.
So there, you know, so there's Genesis, which was an example of, like, they really wanted to do horror, but they sort of rushed into it too much, and they, like, you know, they didn't build up a proper premise or, like, have good explanations for what was going on. And so, you know, it was okay. Like, I rate that episode as maybe a middle, like, set season 7 episode. It wasn't awful, but there's a lot of stuff you can find funny looking back at it. And so then, going way farther down on the terms of bad, we have Macrocosm.
Oh, man.
Do you remember that episode, Bob, of Voyager?
I just recently watched that one.
Oh, man. Okay, do you want to give the recap?
Okay, so, I don't remember where they are, right, but they went to a mine of some sort. They're saying, oh my gosh, there's a virus, this guy's having a problem, we're all sick, our noses are runny. So, Voyager's like, alright, we're gonna help. They go there, and at first I thought it was like a fly or something what was going around. But apparently what this thing is, it's like a virus, but much, much larger.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a big version of a virus that's going around infecting people.
Yep.
And eventually the growth cycle, I guess, of this virus makes it huge. So like the size of, like, I don't know, like a beach ball or something is what it is. And it becomes a hunt down of like, oh my gosh, we need to kill all these things with phasers. Oh, phasers aren't working because there's so many of them. Now let's go ahead and release these antibodies.
Well, and the important part to remember is that, like, the crew gets infected off-screen.
They do.
Unlike Genesis, we don't see both the initial infection and then the hunting of it. We just see Janeway comes back. Janeway and Neelix come back from talking with the Tac-Tac.
The Tac-Tac, who have the best language.
Oh, goodness. The interpretive dance people. So anyway, they come back from talking with them and find the ship is all drifting and, like, everyone's they don't know where anyone is. Neelix gets, like, grabbed by a penis monster.
Does have many phalluses all over.
Yeah, it does.
True.
And, like, phalluses are a tried and true term, like, you know, trope in horror, but they're usually a little more subtle than that. if you want a really good breakdown of horror movies, you should go watch Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, which is a really, really good movie about this guy who wants to be a slasher. And it talks about all the tropes of horror movies, and it's really great.
Is it a parody film, or is it an actual horror film?
It's totally a parody film.
Okay.
But it has horror at the end, is the great part of it.
Gotcha.
Because you spend all this time with this guy, and he seems like a normal dude, and he's going through all the things you have to do to be a slasher. One of my favorite parts is when he talks about how, like, he has to do, like, 2 hours of cardio every day, because as a slasher, you have to be able to run really fast while making it look like you're just walking. And, you know, they talk about his what they call the Captain Ahab, which is, like, the avenging angel who comes in and tries to kill the monster and usually gets killed by the monster. We always called that a bear hunter, because there's this one Jason episode where that character explains why he has all this gear at Crystal Lake, and he says he's going bear hunting. when he's actually there to hunt Jason.
Huh, okay.
But anyway, that movie's great. And that movie has a much more subtle explanation of how the phallic and yonic, which is the opposite of phallic, symbols work in horror movies. But in Macrocosm, the alien just has a bunch of dicks everywhere.
Yep.
And so basically, after Neelix gets nabbed, Janeway has to run around the ship with a phaser rifle and a knife, like shooting aliens until they can release this bomb of antivirals that will kill the alien, that will kill the virus, because the doctor is still around, of course.
Yep.
And of course, the first question that comes to my mind when watching this episode is, if Janeway can fight these things with just one person and a phaser rifle, how did they ever take over the ship in the first place? It's like, you know,
were Voyager... they infecting the gel packs too?
Yeah, that was how it originally started, was that one of them infected the gel packs, because freaking everything can infect the gel packs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can't infect gel packs? And that, like, that's caused the initial infection, because the gel pack exploded and, like, infected everyone in the mess hall.
Uh-huh.
But then, once the virus has moved past that stage and became, like, their basketball size, which is actually a significant hindrance for the virus, because once it's that big, you can shoot it with a phaser.
Yep.
But they moved to that size when there were still a fair number of crewmen left.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, guys, they're not really that hard to shoot. I mean, they're kind of fast, but if you get, like, four people with phasers in a hallway, it shouldn't be that hard to take them out. It's even discounting the possibility of wide beam setting,
mm-hmm.
Which may or may not exist.
It does, because there was an episode of Voyager where Tuvok stuns the entire bridge crew with a phaser.
Yes, that did happen, and that's the reason why it might exist. But most episodes ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So, even as discounting wide beam setting, you should still have been able to just hunt those viruses down with a couple of good security teams.
Yep.
And then, of course, the special effects are just really cheesy looking, whereas in Genesis, Worf, like Monster Worf actually looked pretty good, as did Troy with her creepy frog makeup.
Yep.
And like, you know, all the others. The viruses in this movie, in Macrocosm, were just crappy special effects, CGI, and they really didn't look real. Like, there's this one scene where the doctor is, like, wrestling with one, and it's so obvious he's wrestling with empty air that they pasted a monster into.
Mm.
Like, it doesn't look like he's actually touching anything.
Well, I'm not going to harsh on Voyager too hard for that, because there were a lot of TV shows around that time, especially when Macrocosm came out, that were trying to use CGI, and it did look terrible in all these shows, because the budget just wasn't there for good CGI to be a thing. Now, in movies, we had pretty good CGI. I mean, Jurassic Park was kind of the first movie that used CGI, and had it look really good. You know, Jurassic Park, I think, still holds up as a good movie with that CGI.
Yeah, it does.
But that's the kind of budget that you would throw at movies as the thing for CGI, not at TV shows. So TV shows had CGI, but it was really bad-looking CGI. Now, the ultimate thing they could have done was try to make some sort of puppeteer monster, right?
Well, I'm still going to harsh on them, because even though this was due to the technological limitations, they should have known better. They shouldn't have tried to do this story with the technological limitations being what they were.
But it's the best, dude. It's the best. Look.
It's not. I mean, it's not like I'm looking at this now, like, 20 years later, and being like, ooh, it's so bad. Like, when I saw it, when it first came out, I was like, that's really cheesy looking.
Oh, no, I agree. It's just that, you know, they want to be able to tout the... I mean, and I would think it was successful for them to say, hey, we are touting CGI, along with all the other TV shows that were using CGI at the time. It was just a thing they put on their resume to say, yeah, we're using CGI, which, I mean, is, you know, it's a plus.
And then a lot of this was also, like, Macrocosm also came right on the heels of First Contact, which we'll get to a little bit later, but it was sort of trying to follow the whole action horror vibe that First Contact had.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you know, really, but, like, even with that, there are too many questions, and there just isn't really enough dread. They explain everything way too quickly, at which point it just becomes a pretty standard, let's shoot the alien monster with a phaser, and there isn't really any kind of psychological, like, threat going on, because the monsters look so silly, they're not really engaging any of your fear impulses.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I like Kate Mulgrew as an actor, I really do. I don't blame Kate Mulgrew for any of Janeway's failings, but Kate Mulgrew doesn't really have the arms to be running around without a jacket on and pretending to be badass, because
so
her arms are really thin, and, like, they, you know, it just, like, she looks fine with the uniform on, but when she takes off the uniform jacket, it's just like, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
You need to hit the gym. And I, you know, and that's not really a criticism. It's just that, again, this is a more case that the creative people should have realized this was not the right role for Captain Janeway.
Yep.
It was not something she should have been doing. And so it was just kind of hard to get around that. I will give the episode credit for one thing, and that is that Janeway had an actual knife and not some kind of stupid space knife. like I was half expecting it to be like, you know, like a spanner knife that had like a laser coming out the front or something. But no, it was just a regular knife, which I don't... Does she ever actually use? Does she use it to cut a virus at some point?
Not that I recall.
I don't remember her using it, but whatever. She had a knife. That episode for me also brought into the question why phaser rifles exist, because the phaser rifle didn't seem any more effective at killing it than the pistol, and it was just larger and harder to carry.
Were they starting to use the first contact rifles at that
point? Yes, they had dropped those really silly-looking fork rifles.
Yes.
Yeah, they weren't using those. But yeah, they were using the first contact rifles, which, you know, where they got those is anyone's guess. But the phaser rifles to me always seemed kind of silly because they didn't seem to be any more effective than a phaser pistol, and they were just much larger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just as like that, in the RPG, a phaser rifle is exactly the same as a phaser pistol, except that it fires more shots because it has a larger power pack. Yeah. And you can get around that just by carrying a second power pack, which is still way less bulky than a phaser rifle. So phaser rifles just seem kind of silly. but... All right, so moving on to another episode, which is actually fairly effective in terms of horror, is Silent Enemy from Enterprise. And I know it's weird that I'm holding up Enterprise as an example of success in anything.
Ooh.
Look, you don't
mark this day in your calendars, everybody.
Yeah, I know, right? But Silent Enemy, for those of you who haven't seen a lot of Enterprise, is one of the very few good episodes.
Now, this is the one where this is early in the series, right?
Yeah.
And they find the ship that's got all the people hanging upside down with the tubes in them, right?
No.
No.
No, this is different.
Okay.
This is an episode where, although there is some indication that maybe this ship might be from the same race as the people who put in the pumps, but that's not actually what's going on. This is the episode where they're installing the phase cannons, and the ship shows up, this really scary-looking, dark green enemy ship. Literally, it shows up, it scans them, and then it leaves. And they're like, huh, what was up with that? And then it comes back, and it shoots them a bit. And then it leaves. And, like, they're trying to... They're like, their weapons are completely useless. They can't scan it. Then the third time it comes back, it beats the crap out of them, sends over some dudes who, like, injure two crewmen and, like, do some weird experiments on them, and then leave. And again, even their hand weapons are useless against these aliens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like... And it's actually really effective in terms of creeping dread and a fear of the unknown, because this ship is behaving in such an erratic manner. We don't know why it's doing what it's doing. It will not answer hails. It will not explain itself.
Mm-hmm.
We just know that it shows up and that it can kick Enterprise ass, and that Enterprise is not prepared to deal with it. And then, on the other side of things, what we have is the Enterprise crew kind of rallying together to try to overcome, you know, both the physical enemy and their own fear of it.
Mm-hmm.
As they, you know, empower themselves by installing the phase cannons. Which is sort of a classic scene from a lot of horror movies where, like, there will come a moment where the survivor will finally arm themselves, and that will be
find kind of, the gun shop.
Yeah, find that
or
will
the
be,
hardware store.
Yeah, that will be like an empowering moment, and sometimes it's a little cheesy, but sometimes it works very well. And they do that in this episode, and then they finally are able to defeat the aliens through what I think is kind of a silly plot. They like purposefully overload the phasers. And it's kind of like, you know, if the phasers could be overloaded safely, why aren't they always set to that level?
Well, it wasn't really safe at the time when they were doing it.
Yeah, they did some
sparks on the bridge.
Yeah, they did some damage to but Reed was able to majigger it so that it didn't do too much. And it was like, you know, that just seems like something would be standard procedure if your phasers weren't doing enough damage.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it's in general, it's a pretty good movie, or episode, and it shows... You know, it shows Archer not being stupid, which is kind of weird for Archer. He doesn't do anything really weird or silly. The only thing that's really detracting from it is that during this whole really tense encounter, we have Hoshi running around trying to figure out what Reed's favorite food is.
Yeah, there's that B-plot,
That stupid B-plot, and it's like, what is this B-plot even doing in this episode? Like, who put this B-plot in here? Did you honestly not think that this, like, menacing, unstoppable enemy... was not enough to fill out an entire episode. I mean, as a as SF Debris put it, it would be like in Best of Both Worlds, there was a side plot where Troy was trying to find a piece for Riker's trombone, like in the middle of the Borg fight. And, you know, that's really, it was really silly, really out of place, and it really just made you wonder why the hell Hoshi is on the ship in the first place, because apparently she's just become the errand girl. Like, there is no low crewman who could be assigned this task. No, it had to be Hoshi.
Oh, man, have Seth MacFarlane get over that.
Hmm?
Remember because Seth MacFarlane's a crewman on the ship?
Oh, right, yeah.
He had, like, two little
I would have loved to see Seth MacFarlane.
Seth MacFarlane tries to find what that type of food.
Speaking of which, supposedly Seth MacFarlane is interested in doing another Star Trek show, and there's no indication that he ever actually will. He himself said he doesn't know who would let him do it, but he said that if he was offered, he totally would.
Oh, yeah.
And I would actually be interested to see that. I think that would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, sorry, Seth MacFarlane tangent. So, like, there's, you know, there's at first, you know, it follows a pretty classic trope where first there's the disempowerment scenario where the ship shows up and it's way better than they are. And then there's later on, we talked about the empowerment where they get their face cannons online and are like, yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, it raises the questions of why the hell they ever left space dock without the face cannons. Because also the face cannons weren't invented yet. It was that Archer decided to leave without them because he was just so impatient to get into space.
The man's on Tuesday. I don't have until Tuesday.
Yeah, I don't have until Tuesday.
Yeah, Klingons get back to their homeworld.
Right. And so that was
4 days away.
Yeah, so despite some of the logical issues that it comes up with, it was presented so well that it was, you know, that it actually ended up being very effective. And if other episodes of Enterprise had been like that, maybe it wouldn't have gotten canceled. And maybe it would have actually been a decent show that we wouldn't all, like, you know, hand face palm at whenever we think about it.
Yep. I really like how your girlfriend's mom,
Ripley,
handled Enterprise was by watching Lex.
Oh, right, yeah, that's a great story. My girlfriend Lillian's mother, Elizabeth, she watched Enterprise after watching all of Lex, and according to her, Enterprise is really good if you watch it after watching Lex.
So remember, guys, the key to watching Enterprise is watching something worse.
Yep.
Before it.
And I can definitely see why Lex would be my opinion on Lex is that everyone should watch the first episode of Lex, because Lex is an experience. Ooh. I don't think you should ever watch more than that, but I think you should watch the first episode.
I made the mistake of watching, like, the first four episodes.
Oh, goodness. I don't know why.
I haven't recovered to this day.
Okay. That's why you keep, like, that's why you scuba dive. It's because you need to get away from, you know, you're fleeing the world that exposed you to Lex.
I am desperately trying to.
All right, so going back to TNG for a moment, Bob wanted to talk a little bit about Sub Rosa.
Yes, I feel this is actually probably the only true episode, Halloweenish episode that we have.
And I have to say, the reason why I didn't originally include Sub Rosa on this list wasn't because I was like, I hate Sub Rosa. It didn't occur to me. Like, when I was thinking of Star Trek horror episodes, Sub Rosa did not come to mind.
Well, it's such a classic, like, ghost story, though. Yeah. I mean, despite the fact that, you know, Rowan, the, you know, and chief antagonist is just like, you know, yeah, I'm this non-corporeal being that came to Earth, and I've been, like, hanging out with your family for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Now, you might want to give a recap, because I don't know how many people have actually seen Sub Rosa.
All right, so Dr. Crusher has to go back to the planet, A-Planet, I'm actually sure if she was born here or not, that is a colony world that is modeled after Scotland. Scottish Highlands is what it is.
I think this is the episode where we find out that Crusher was an orphan. I don't think we knew that before.
Wait, was she an orphan?
Yeah, she was totally an orphan. She was raised by her grandmother.
Oh, yeah, huh.
That was the plot is that her grandmother is dead, and she has to go back for a funeral.
Right,
and
exactly.
She talks about how her grandmother.
I didn't realize she was an orphan, though.
Yeah, her grandmother raised her after her parents died, and I don't think we knew that about Crusher until this episode.
But
I'm pretty sure that's what it was revealed.
Anyway, yeah, she goes there because her grandmother's now dead, and she's there to, one, be at the funeral, and then two, take care of any kind of, like, affairs like the house and things like that, personal belongings and such.
She has to sell the house to get not money.
Yeah, well, whatever. Anyway, she ends up meeting this fella named Rowan, which was revealed to be her grandmother's lover, quote-unquote lover, even though he looks like he's like 30 or so.
Well, the picture of her grandmother actually made her look pretty, like, that was the weird thing, was that, like, her grandmother looked fairly young.
All old people that are, you know, that we should care about all look young.
Well, that was actually part of the story, is that her grandmother was unusually young looking for her age.
Yeah. But, anyway, so they eventually get into a relationship, the Crusher and this, Rowan fella.
Yep.
And she...
Which is creepy as hell, let me tell you.
Because there's this one scene where Crusher's just hanging out, and she becomes kind of like semi-possessed or so, and it's very obvious that, you know, they're doing the deed right there in her chair.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's not actually there, so. This happens on the ship a couple times, and then also on the planet, in the house. Later on in the episode, it's revealed that he wants her to stay. She's deciding to stay anyway, just because she's so madly in love with this Rowan character. And he sabotaged something about the planet's weather system for some reason. I'm not sure why, though.
Yeah, I don't remember why he did that.
Something to do with the other guy being onto him as an alien or something like that. I don't know. I don't remember. But anyway.
He had I remember he had a confrontation scene with Picard that never really went anywhere. Like, Picard was like, hey, what's up with you? And he's like, well, I'm a real person that is in love with Crusher. And Picard was like, I don't trust you. And then he left. And he didn't really do anything.
Yeah, nothing really came of it. Anyway, there's kind of this investigation type, you know, string that leads through, and they find out that, you know, he's actually a bad dude. And he starts, like, possessing, like, the grandmother of Crusher, and, you know, Crusher comes disillusioned. It's like, oh my gosh, you need to stop this. And there's this big confrontation scene at the end where she has to destroy a candle so that he's got nowhere to go.
Yeah, the candle is effectively his phylactery, because he's a incorporeal alien that has to, like, that has to exist near it in order to stay alive.
Yeah, but the episode is very much a commentary on, like, hey, there's, like, maybe a thing called ghosts. Or they're non-corporeal beings from space.
Maybe. I just remember thinking that, the romance between them felt really silly. And I don't remember if the implication was that he had some kind of supernatural or, like, mind powers over her. Or if she was actually just falling in love with him that quickly.
Well, if he has the power to, you know, possess somebody. Like a dead body, even.
Yeah.
You know, I think he probably has the ability to, you know, jump into somebody as we saw. And give him just orgasmic pleasure, as we saw.
I guess. I remember being really confused as to what it was he actually wanted from her. Like, at first I thought that he was, like, sucking the life force out of her.
He's just existing.
Yeah.
Is what it is, I think.
He's
and,
just there.
He's deriving that pleasure and energy from it.
But it seemed to be, like, kind of symbiotic. Because, again, like, a plot point that I recall was that her grandmother was, like, very young for her age.
Well, it was symbiotic in the fact that, you know, the Howard women, which is, it's the Howard clan, is what, you know, Crusher's family is.
Right.
You know, are, you know, receiving pleasure from this. Now, the problem with that is that's kind of putting their lives on hold.
Yeah.
Especially in Crusher's case, because it's like she suddenly just resigns from Starfleet and wants to go live on the planet in the house with Rowan.
Man, if I had a nickel for every time someone resigned from Starfleet.
I mean, so it was destructive to what her previous career goals were for her life.
Yeah.
I mean, for her grandmother, probably not so much, because her grandmother always lived on the planet, I think, as far as I know. She was always there.
Yeah, but
so
we don't know what kind of dreams her grandmother had before she got seduced by this ghost.
Yeah, but, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, well, no, because she was always... Crusher was talking about how her grandmother was always on the planet and come up with, like, herbal remedies and more kind of natural medicine, is what it was. So, I mean, she always lived there, and her ambition was to be more or less, you know, the country doctor on this Scottish colony world.
Just a simple country doctor.
And it sounds like she just kept doing that.
Yeah,
you know, right. And then Rowan was around.
But, like, didn't I was a little unclear. Do you remember, when is it that Rowan is supposed to have met her grandmother? Like, was it, like, I thought the idea was that he was around basically from her birth. Because I know that he's been in her clan for a long time. So I don't know when it was that he was supposed to have passed on to her. And it makes me kind of wonder if maybe he was influencing her from, like, early childhood.
Maybe she, got the candle from another relative at some point.
I guess.
Later in life. Because, I mean, families get bigger as time goes on, typically.
Yeah, I can imagine Crusher going back through her family pool, her family, like, genealogy, and being like, all right, I wonder which of these women was seduced by the Scottish ghost.
I mean, because the claim was that he'd been around since, like, the 16th century or something, or 17th century or sometime, like, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. He's been just, like, seducing Howard women.
All right, so I'm betting... All right, she looks like she was probably seduced by this ghost. I don't think she was, though. I'm just imagining her going through these family photos and trying to figure out which of her ancestors was being seduced by a ghost. God, that's creepy.
So it's not really a horror story in the sense that we're dealing with, like, startling or, like, any sort of, like, monster hunting like we do with Macrocosm or anything like that. But it's definitely, I feel, a story about, it's like, psychological horror.
Yeah, I guess. I can agree. I can see where you're coming from. I just remember, as watching the episode, I was very confused for most of it. Because I wasn't really sure what the ghost wanted, and if he was actually a bad guy or not. I couldn't really tell. I knew that everyone was acting like he was a bad guy, but I wasn't sure, like, how much of this was from him.
Well, he was acting in a way, I feel he was probably acting in a way that wasn't, well, maybe for the most part, because he was still existing, we didn't have phasers yet to, you know, blow him away, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago in the 17th century, but he'd just been preying on these Howard women for the emotional release and to have companionship and such through the ages, and he just happened to select the Howard women for that. Now, it only became a problem when it became very apparent that it was being destructive to someone else's life.
Right, right.
Because, you know, it didn't seem like it was very destructive at all to her grandmother's life.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, as soon as you start messing around with my career plans, it's on like Donkey Kong.
That's an interesting story. Yeah, all right. Okay, well, that's like, I can totally see that as a psychological horror now that you've given it, like, hearing you talk about it, I think makes the episode make a little bit more sense to me. But I just, when I watched it, I had a hard time drawing that.
Because the whole thing definitely was at first seeming like it was going to be like the books like my mom reads, where it's like this, you know, romance story with Fabio on the front was what it was going to be.
Oh goodness!
Now, you know who Fabio is, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So that's what it was playing out to be. Then it's kind of like, you know, okay, he's a non-corporeal being. Okay, that's cool. That makes sense. Okay. Makes sense to me anyway.
You get some sci-fi in this romance plot.
Yeah, exactly. At first I wasn't feeling it. I'm like, oh, okay, gotcha.
Interesting how many of... I've said this before, but I've always found it funny how many of Crusher's stories are not in any way related to medicine. Like, most of the Crusher-based stories are not medicine at all. Like, a lot of them are investigation stories.
Well, I don't have a problem with that, really, at all. And that goes for really any character that's taken out of their, you know, career element. Like, I certainly don't want to see Geordi solving engineering problems all the time.
Geordi doesn't really actually solve a whole lot of engineering problems.
Well, there we go.
Most of the problems that Geordi solves revolves around whether or not he can see something, not whether or not he can fix something.
Well, something that's very apparent for their person, whether it be engineering skills or I have a really awesome visor that lets me see electromagnetic wave pulses or some nonsense.
Yeah.
That'd be, you know, it's much more interesting to see the characters develop, and you don't get a whole lot of development if you're waving a tricorder or something saying, yeah, they got the cold.
Yeah, I feel like they did a better job, they did a pretty good job with that with Bashir, because Bashir has a lot of really good medical drama.
He does.
I honestly wish there had been a little bit more medical drama with Crusher, because it just... Sometimes it was hard for me to remember that Crusher was the chief surgeon, because she didn't seem to spend a whole lot of time being the chief medical officer. It didn't really seem like she was that important to the ship's medical goings-on.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I'm getting a bit off topic here. So next up is what I think is the best, one of the best straight-up horror movie episodes of Star Trek, and that is Empok Nor.
Yes.
Of Deep Space Nine. And I love this episode. Because it focuses around two of my favorite characters, incidentally, O'Brien and Garak.
Yep.
So for the recap, Empok Nor is the name of the episode, and it is also this other Cardassian station that they go to, which is basically the same built as DS9, but for some reason it's drifting sideways.
Yep, it's drifting sideways in space, which makes it seem like, oh man, it's broken and busted and old.
Yeah, because everyone knows that in space,
it's
everyone
tilted 45 degrees, yeah, it must be broken.
Everyone in space works along the same, like, axis, and so if your ship is tilted off that axis, it means something's wrong with it.
No, something's wrong.
But they go there because they need some parts. And, like, yep. You know, and, like, Bashir, excuse me, not Bashir, O'Brien, Nog, Garak, and then some extras. Who I think some of them were actually in previous episodes as, like, B-cast. So I don't think that this was the first time we'd seen any of them. I think some of them had been there before, although I'm hard-pressed to remember which ones.
I don't remember seeing any of them or anything else.
But, you know, they go to the station.
Maybe it was extras,
yeah,
and their contracts were up or something.
And, like, right off the bat, this episode has the same sort of lighting as Genesis, but it has a much better explanation. The station has been abandoned for years,
been just drifting in space.
And it was actually abandoned, so it's like, okay, they probably turned off all the power systems when they left, and as opposed to just, you know, the ship just not having anyone there for a week.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, you know, at first it's just atmosphere. It takes a while before anything actually happens. There's a lot of, like, you know, there's a lot of suspense. We don't know who the bad guys are. We just know that they're dangerous. They start killing a couple of the extra crew members, who the episode actually spends some time getting us interested in them and, like, getting us to know their problems. And we spend the first few minutes, like, not the first few minutes, excuse me, but, like, a while of the episode just listening to them talk and getting us involved with them in a way that's hard for us to get involved in a bunch of teenagers who just want to do it in the sack.
Yep.
And so then, like, once they actually start being taken out, it's actually very upsetting, and we're like, oh man, we don't want them to die, and we're invested. And, you know, it starts, and eventually it's revealed that the monsters are three.
It was gonna be four, but apparently one of them, the pods failed or something.
Yeah. These three, Cardassian soldiers who were, like, bioengineered to be even more xenophobic than your regular Cardassian, and were, like, elite shock troopers that were left behind in stasis because they were considered, like, a failed experiment. But they get released, and they go around hunting the non-Cardassians. And eventually they're able to take them all out, and Garak, like, becomes, like, is starting to get weirder and weirder as this goes on.
Well, he was starting to get affected by the same thing that was affecting them.
Right, exactly. I was getting to that. I was doing some build-up. Thanks, Bob. But yeah, he, like, as the story progresses, he starts to act weirder and weirder, and, like, you know, creepier and creepier, and then he, because he's been, like, you know, his mind is being affected by the same stuff that's affecting them, he eventually loses it. Like, after he kills the last one, he also kills the last non-main cast member, and then captures Nog. And he has this really great line where the guy's like, you know, where the last non-main cast member, Amaro, I think is his name, is, like, talking to Garak, and he's like, all right, well, he's like, we got them all, but damn it, they got, you know, crewman, I forget what her X. name, but they got crewman, you know, Seltzer. And it's like, I just turned my back for a second. He asked me to go get, like a hydro spanner, and he shows it to Garak, and Garak's like, that's a shame, especially because this isn't a hydro spanner. It's a flux coupler. And then he stabs him with it.
Yep.
And it's like, you know, it's like, oh crap. Because, you know, Garak has always been a little weird, right? Like, uh-huh. You know, he's always been mysterious and creepy, and he's like intentionally, like, you know, he intentionally maintains that mystique. And then suddenly he's actively trying to murder us. And he's been, like, you know, established as one of the most highly skilled characters on the show. He can, you know, he can fight, he can fly, he can hack, he can make bombs. It's like, you know, he's like, you know, the Cardassian James Bond is what he is.
Heck yeah.
And suddenly he has turned against the characters, and it's like, oh man. And then on the other side of it, to make things, like, to give us, like, a more character building, is O'Brien. And O'Brien is dealing, in this episode, O'Brien is dealing with his memories of the first Cardassian border wars, and his experience at Set, like, 3. And this episode is both about him having to accept that that happened,
mm-hmm.
And he has to draw on that to fight Garak, but then also to move on and not live in the past anymore. And that's sort of exemplified by the way he eventually defeats Garak is by a jury-rigged engineered bomb as opposed to just fighting him straight up.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a lot of, you know, catharsis at the end. And then, of course, Garak is really scary. I'm forgetting the name of Garak's actor. I should have written that down.
But Andrew G. Robinson.
Yeah, he did a really good job. Apparently, the early versions of the script were not very good.
Really?
Like, the first draft didn't have any of it was originally going to be, like, Garak and Worf, and there wasn't really a whole lot of characterization going on. It was just sort of a standard, oh, there's evil murderers on the loose. And then, you know, the actor, Garak's actor, whose name you just said, but I forgot.
Andrew G. Robinson.
Yeah, Andrew G. Robinson. He looked at it and he was like, there's not really anything going on here with Garak. I can't see Garak acting this way.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, Ira Stephen Bear looked at it and was like, there's nothing here going on for the characters. This episode is just kind of filler. And so the writer looked at it and was like, yeah, I guess you're right. And he went back and he wrote another draft. He replaced it. He replaced Worf with O'Brien and added in O'Brien's, like, war record and made the whole thing way more interesting and gave Garak his, like, moment at the end where after he's had the drugs flushed out of the system, he's really remorseful because, you know, even though Garak is, you know, he can be callous if he needs to be. The idea that he killed someone for no reason just because he was, you know, being affected by drugs makes him feel real bad.
Mm-hmm.
And we see, you know, it's also character growth for Garak. Even a little bit of character growth for Nog, actually. Although the most important thing Nog does in that episode is get taken prisoner.
He comes loaded, like, ready to hunt bear.
Yeah, he's got his giant phaser rifle.
Loaded for bear.
He knows what's up. And just that entire episode is really good, and it exemplifies all the horror tropes we were talking about earlier with the unknown and this threat, and then twisting the familiar because Garak is our friend, but suddenly he's not our friend anymore, and nope. It really, like, pulls the rug out from under us.
Well, he was my friend.
I thought he wasn't your friend.
He was my friend.
He was still your friend?
He was still my friend.
Okay. Well, he's still my friend afterwards. Garrick is my favorite character, incidentally. So it's no real surprise that I would like this episode. And, of course, this episode was also set up for The Magnificent Ferengi, where they went back to M'Pok Nor, and I really like that episode, too. So, you know, I'm a fan of M'Pok Nor. Good things happen on M'Pok Nor.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so, finally, we're going to take a jump back over to TNG.
Oh, man.
When we're going to talk about the Borg.
The Borg.
And the Borg, let me tell you, are probably the ultimate horror villains in Star Trek. And are arguably the best villains that Star Trek has ever had.
Yep. Well, up until Voyager.
Well, yeah, Voyager happened and kind of that ship sort of set sail. But before Voyager, the Borg are just masterful in a lot of ways. First, because every other alien race that Star Trek had really run into at that point as antagonists had been pretty much humans with, like, who were meaner. And then suddenly we had the Borg, who were, like, completely inhuman. They had the whole hive mind thing going, and they were, like, you know, arguably a metaphor for communism. And, you know, there was all this weirdness going on with them, and that what they wanted wasn't, like, terribly clear. Like, they didn't want to take over you or rule you. They just wanted to consume you.
Yep.
And it was like, you know, oh my goodness, that was just a whole another level of frightening. And then, of course, they were effectively invincible. When we first met them, that, like, weapons just did not work.
Yep.
You know, you could shoot them a couple of times, and they were just like, no, okay, we're good. And they just
come at me, bro.
You know, they just kept coming, and Q sums it up really well when he's like, you know, they will follow you until you exhaust your fuel. Like, if you fight back, they will come back stronger. They are relentless.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, oh goodness. And they were like, they were coming out of, like, the dark of space, which is, like, you know, the ultimate unknown. We had mm-hmm. no idea where they came from or who they were. And then, you know, and then they even hit another, like, clear point when they kidnap Picard and turn him into, like, Cutis.
Yeah.
And it's suddenly like, wow, Picard, who was, like, you know, our loving, like, father figure almost for most of the show, is suddenly our enemy. And even though they sabotaged that a little bit because they had, like, that was a great moment for Riker's character development, and then they sort of sabotaged it by just bringing Picard back afterwards, but it was still really effective. And then the whole, like, the battle at Wolf 359, which happened off-screen, which I actually think was more effective than it would be if they'd had it on-screen.
Yep.
You know, because it was just like the Enterprise flying through this graveyard of ships. Some of which looked kind of goofy if you actually looked close, because there was, like, a whole bunch of shoving kits of certain, like, you know, one half of one ship onto the bottom half of another ship.
My favorites were the Excelsior study variants and whatnot.
Yeah. And they had, like, one that was just a squashed Galaxy class. So it was, you know, that was a little goofy, but that was only something you'd notice if you were really looking closely. And mainly it was just a really effective, like, oh goodness, we're all screwed moment.
Uh-huh.
And the pacing is really good. It just, the atmosphere is really good. The music is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And the Borg, and then what makes the Borg, like, what really elevates them to the next level for me is that the Borg were a very intellectual threat, because, like, you couldn't just fight them until they stopped.
Right.
It wasn't just an issue of shooting them with phasers until they went away. It was mm-hmm. clearly you had to outthink the Borg, and that is how they eventually beat them. And it's not just a silly technobabble explanation either. That's what a lot of people think of when they think of, like, an intellectual scenario. It's like, okay, well, we, you know, diverted positron power to the neutron generators, and that's how we won. But that's just the same as shooting them with phasers until they go away, just with, you know, less cool special effects. You know, the real issue was outsmarting the Borg using Picard's link to them.
Uh-huh.
And so that was, like, you know, and so that was...
Put them to sleep.
Yeah, put them to sleep. And it was, you know, it was, and it worked really well, and it was just, you know, Wolf 359, or excuse me, Best of Both Worlds is probably my favorite Star Trek episode. There are some DS9 episodes that maybe come close, like in The Pale Moonlight. But just as a rule, just one, like, probably the most famous episode of Star Trek, it's the one that almost everyone remembers. If they've seen any Star Trek, they've probably seen Best of Both Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And
it did hold number one spot in Viewer's Choice Marathon when TNG came to an end in 94.
Yep, that makes sense to me. And then, of course, the Borg, and then First Contact happened. And First Contact, even though I like it as a movie, it did kind of downgrade the Borg. Because first of all, like, suddenly the Borg were just another threat. Like, you could just, if you shot them with enough lasers, they were gonna die. Like,
shoot the same spot.
Yeah, everyone shoot the same spot. That's the trick.
That's the trick.
And so it's like, it made them way less scary that you could just shoot them again. And they would stop. And part of that was actually not entirely First Contact's fault. Part of that came from, Iborg. With the whole, like, we're going to destroy the collective by sending them a computer virus. And then, like, Descent, where it actually sort of indicated that they had succeeded and that the entire collective had been destroyed.
Well, it wasn't the entire collective, it was just that one ship.
Well, we found that out later. But from the way they talk in Descent, it actually sounds like maybe they're talking about the whole collective. Like, we find out later that it was just that one ship. Because it had to have been that one ship. It couldn't have been the whole collective, because then we could never fight the Borg again. But they sort of indicate that it might have been the whole collective in that one in that episode. Like it's weird if you listen to it though. It kind of, you can see how it's lining up for that. But then First Contact, the Borg are way easier to shoot, even though they still have the whole, you know, adaptation after a few shots thing. But like any monster franchise, once you start fighting the monster too much, it's not really that scary anymore. And, like, the Borg became way more about, like, scaring us with their special effects than with their actual, like, danger and their actual, like, psychological threats. Because they got, like, you know, way faster, and they have, like, the whole vampire assimilation tubes now. And that was, you know, it just made them more like, okay, these are just regular sci-fi aliens now. These aren't, like, what the real magic that they had before was kind of lost. Mm-hmm. And then especially the Borg Queen, I think. And I feel like I've been talking a lot about this, Bob. What do you have to say about the Borg?
Really, the Queen actually kind of, I felt, gave the Borg, well, at least until we start seeing her in Voyager a whole bunch,
Yeah. Gave
the Borg actually a little more threat to them again. Because
really?
I feel some of that had been lost with episodes like Descent and iBorg,
mm-hmm.
where I was just like, you know, Borg, whatever, you know. Especially like iBorg, which is just like, yeah, this is now an enemy combatant, and he's really not such a bad guy, you know, when you get to know him and such.
Yeah.
But the Borg Queen very much has an agenda, and she's using this force to make that agenda happen. That agenda simply is, I want to conquer the galaxy, despite the fact that she's saying, oh, I'm looking for perfection and whatnot, right?
Right.
It's very much her acting as an individual controlling the Borg. So it's her wielding her giant club, smacking things away, right? Despite the fact that you can shoot her with lasers, or in this case, the green goo from the warp core.
the vats of flesh-devouring gas.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm never putting those in my warp core, no sir.
I mean, I felt it added more depth to the Borg, despite the fact that, you know, it got dumb in Voyager again. That there was, in fact, a single driving force behind the Borg that wasn't just their collective consciousness. It was her consciousness influencing them.
All right, well, I think that's an interesting view, and I can definitely see why the Borg are a little frustrating after iBorg, especially since iBorg establishes that if you separate a drone from the collective long enough, he'll just become an individual, which is kind of a bad precedent to set, I think. I disagree on the Borg Queen. I think that she just made the Borg feel kind of like any other villain, but I can see where you're coming from. And, you know, it's good to have differing opinions. Makes us stronger, as long as everyone agrees with me.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you over the sound of the Borg drone hum.
Oh, goodness. But even in First Contact, the Borg are still fairly effective as a threat, because they have, like, their whole, like, slowly creeping over the ship. As long as you don't pay too much attention to the whole, what exactly are the Borg back here to do?
Well, it's an unstoppable force.
Yeah,
is
exactly.
What it is that's coming over that horizon. We just can't fight.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, then in Voyager, it turns out they totally can fight it, and the Borg just lose all their teeth, and are like, oh, look, it's a Borg ship. Let's blow it up.
Just a quick side note about the Borg, actually, in Voyager.
Yeah?
I just really recently watched the last episode. Actually, today, I watched the last episode of Season 4.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, where Voyager gets the Nautilus from Starfleet Command, but not really Starfleet Command. It's that one alien who, his entire race suddenly got assimilated because Janeway gave the Borg those nanoprobes to fight A472.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
That guy.
There's this wonderful illustration of Janeway. You're causing a lot of problems in the Delta Quadrant, by the way. Innocent people are dying because of you now, because of your choices.
Yeah, and see, that episode, normally I'm all about choices having consequences, but that episode, for me, was just sort of like, highlighting that, like, when Janeway first made her decision to ally with the Borg, I was like, Janeway, this decision is dumb. This is really stupid. And in this situation, having him show up and be like, yeah, this was a dumb decision, Janeway. It had bad consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of for me, it was like, I kind of almost wished that I'd just never seen that, and just I could have just pretended that the characters knew something that I didn't that made this plan seem reasonable. But it turned out, no, it totally wasn't. It was just a stupid plan.
Yep.
And it was just like, why? Why, Janeway?
Why?
There's a lot of questions that could end with that, I think. It's why, Janeway? But, alright, so I think we've covered most of our bases on Star Trek Horror.
We got pulled a lot out, I feel, despite the fact that Star Trek isn't really a horror series to begin with.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of good horror in Star Trek, even though it's, you know, that isn't really what it focuses on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm actually really excited for next week, which is going to be our 20th episode.
Heck yeah.
Which is, you know, a big milestone for us. We are going to be talking. We should wear hats. You know, I'm totally going to wear, wink, wink, the best hat. That will be so amazing, and you guys will all be able to tell.
We can post pictures. That's the thing we can do. We have cameras in the internet.
Gosh darn it, Bob. Now that we're going to have visual proof, I actually have to get a hat.
Hey, you know, this is the thing I do.
It's cool. I've got a badass.
I don't try to deceive our user base, Oren. Listener base. I do not mislead them.
What's wrong with you?
What's wrong with me?
All right, everyone.
I'm an upstanding individual. That's what's wrong with me. What are we talking about next week?
Next week, we are talking about the Titan novels.
Yes!
Because, you know, we're going to give Bob a chance to be the main guy on conversation, because he has read the Titan novels. I have not, and I'm not going to try to read them in a week.
So I'm gonna totally do it, though.
I'm going to read the Wikipedia summary, and I'll see what I can do from there. All right, everyone. Happy Halloween.
Ooh.